Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on this week's Relax Back UK show. Now, have you ever had a really good heart-to-heart talk with your GP? Probably not. In that case, today's show with Dr. Ian Pandya will be very useful because you can listen to the one that I had. Dr. Pandya is a very experienced GP. He passionately wants to make people better, keep people better, and ideally prevent them from needing to see him in the first place because they are healthy.
But in real life, you only really change your behaviours for a number of reasons. Number one is what I call, you know, the unthinkable. So something terrible happens, like your best friend suddenly has a heart attack or something tragic, and you think, right, that's it. I'm going to make some big changes now. I'm going to stop smoking. I'm going to eat healthily, you know.
We cover a lot of ground. Changing unhealthy behaviour and why people might do that, in the environment of all sorts causing health issues, latent infections, long COVID, vitamin D, digital health, symptom checkers, public health, good information sources to help with health-related decisions, and much else. This is relevant to almost everyone, so please do stay tuned for a great show. Dr. Ian Pandya is a very experienced GP and practices at the surgery I attend in St. Albans. He has written a book called The Health Fix and has a podcast, Saving Lives in Slow Motion. Like all GPs in the NHS currently, he is extremely busy, so I was very lucky to get to chat with him. My first question was, should we take more control of our health and how can we?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, and thanks for having me on, Mike. I think, where do I start with that? The answer, short answer is yes, because of a number of reasons. So firstly, in the UK, we know that access to healthcare is an issue increasingly because of the supply and demand. You know, there's a real, you know, and I don't want to get political, but there's something going on in healthcare at the moment where it's harder and harder to access it.
So that might be another show or another series.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and one for someone who's much more political than I am. But essentially, self-care is really important. And I think, you know, in terms of 0 to 1 self-care, most people know what they need to be doing. You know, eat a bit more healthily, take some exercise, and hope for the best. You know, and that in a way is public health, and that's important. You know, the cornerstone of good health is diet and exercise. There's no sort of doubt. No one's going to argue about that. Then the next bit is about, you know, if you go from 0 to 1 to 1 to 2, is about transformation. So some people just don't feel well and they want to change their behaviours and improve their health. And in my book, I talk about the real life reasons why people change their behaviours. And there's a load of stuff out there by behavioural experts, which is good stuff. But in real life, you only really change your behaviours for a number of reasons. Number one is what I call, you know, the unthinkable. So something terrible happens, like your best friend suddenly has a heart attack or something tragic, and you think, right, that's it. I'm going to make some big changes now. I'm going to stop smoking. I'm going to eat healthily. You know, that no one wants that one. Another one is, you know, what I call friendly jealousy. You bump into an old school friend you haven't seen in years and they look fantastic and you think, wow, they've really transformed themselves. I want a bit of that. So that gears you into doing
nodding my head vigorously at that one. Yeah
And another one would be what I call under orders, which is where someone else's rules mean that you can't do anything unhealthy. So for example, you can't smoke cigarettes on a flight if you're a smoker, and you don't really think about smoking if you're a smoker on a flight because you can't do it, but the minute you get off, you know, the first thing you do is light a fag. So there's something about rules. And one of the other ones is called community spirit. So parkrun is a great example of this, where doing something in a group somehow has this sort of magical power compared to trying to do something on your own. Do you know what I mean? So those are just sort of some ideas in terms of what makes people tick and why you would change your behaviours in the first place. And if you're someone who's sitting there thinking, do you know what, I really need to get going with stuff, I just don't quite know how to do it, those are some ideas for you. The last one, by the way, is called is brute force or willpower, which isn't easy. So some people, very rarely, some people can just go, do you know what, I'm never smoking again, and stub out their last fag and never smoke again. But that is really hard. Most people can't do that because that's requiring you to sort of stop doing something that you want to do. You've actually got to kind of remove the want for the bad habit. And in the book, I talk about replacements. We've all done this. I used to get through a packet of biscuits in my old surgery in Tottenham about 20 years ago. By the end of a morning, I'd eat through a whole packet of biscuits, and I knew it was bad, but I just couldn't stop doing it because, the receptionist would just bring in more cups of coffee. And eventually what I had to do was replace that with fruit because I was feeling so awful by the end of the day. I was tired and irritable, because my sugar levels were all over the place. But replacing it with a banana and an apple and some berries, although you don't get that satisfaction that you do when you eat a donut or biscuits because it takes longer for your blood sugar to come up. By the end of a week, if you stick with something like that, you feel lighter and brighter. And I think this is part of the thing. Once people feel better, they realize that it was worth the investment.
Sure.
Often people just sort of give up on a habit because they think, well, I've been to the gym twice and I feel terrible. But
Yeah.
it's not that. It's about little and often. You've got to do.
Let me just interject here because you've done that and you gave a good example, but in the nicest possible way, you're not normal, actually. Most of us are pretty rubbish at changing our habits and changing our ways. And if I am probably 2 stone overweight, and actually I was at the practice. I didn't see you. I saw another doctor, and essentially he said, look, you should really think about losing some weight. And I'm relatively motivated, I like to think, but it didn't work. Most of us, although we know it's the right thing to do, we're pretty rubbish at it, and we might even get worse at it when someone who's a doctor points their finger and say, look, pal, you need to do something about that. We kind of dig our heels in. So, but collectively, what's wrong with us?
I totally agree with you, and and actually, I'm not good at it. That's why I wrote the book. I'm not good at it. I really need help with it, And actually, that sort of the example I gave from my old surgery was because I just felt terrible. And that this is one of the things. Once someone feels awful and they seek help, they're desperate and they'll do anything. You almost don't need behaviour change because someone will say, "Do you know what? If you just do this, this, and this, you'll feel better." And often, a lot of my patients are in that position. They're broken, whereas you're not. You've just gone in and someone's just said, do you know what? You might need to look at your weight. Going back to what I was saying about 0 to 1 and 1 to 2. So when I transgressed, I sort of went off on a tangent on behavior change. 0 to 1, as I said, is with simple things like diet and exercise. Level 2 is transformation, where you do those things and actually you do transform your health using those tools that I said about behavior change. Level 3 is what I call symptom resolution. And a few 50 years ago, there's no way that a doctor would say that that was possible without drugs or surgery. But it is. And a lot of my work is to do with people who just don't feel well. So they come in with nebulous symptoms like not being able to digest their food properly, headaches, palpitations, feeling tired all the time. These are the things that clog up a GP's consulting room. And the answer is not to do with drugs. And in terms of behavior change and how you make that stick, the easiest way is, so say for example, let's take you, Mike, and the fact that you want to, lose a bit of weight, and you're probably, I'm guessing that you're relatively healthy anyway. I know you run
Yeah,
and all sorts of
pretty
stuff.
good.
And so that might need a different approach. If you're already doing the right things, then that needs a deeper dive into looking at things like timing of meals and all sorts, which we can talk about. But the easiest way to add into a new behavior to your life is to stick it onto an existing one. I'll tell you one that I do myself. So I'm not a member of a gym. I've never really got on with them. I've got no problem with them. It's just not for me. I much prefer the outdoors or things I can do in my time. But the whole little and often thing is key. So upstairs in my bathroom, which I use to have a shower every morning, I've got some weights. And before I get in the shower, I use them and I do some squats and I do a sort of very quick, literally 1 minute. It's almost nothing. but I do it every day. And that means cumulatively, you know, if I had a twin brother that wasn't doing that, you know, and you measured our biceps, not that mine are very big, you know, mine would be bigger by the end of a year, because I'm actually sort of, it's because I'm busy and I can fit in a minute a day. What I can't do is take an hour out to go to a gym. I just can't do it. It doesn't work for me. And the first thing about behavior change is you've got to, the question I ask in the consultation, which is not in any textbooks, is, and this particularly goes for that person I was describing who's a bit broken. Years ago, I used to get irritated by it, because often they'd come in at the end of a Monday morning after I've seen 25 patients anyway.
And in the packet of biscuits.
And they're an extra, you know, they've been fitted in as an emergency. They've often been forced there by their partner, and they go, look, I don't know where to start. I think I'm depressed. I've got joint pains. I can't eat my food. I'm getting palpitations. I've got headache. And I used to go, I'm really, really sorry, but this is like an emergency appointment. It's like 1 o'clock now. And I can only deal with one of those things. The reality is they're all interconnected. This person is in a state of system malfunction. And one of the things that you realize is when you get lots of symptoms, your biological systems are out of whack. And the first thing I ask them, and this is something I want, you know, all your listeners to do, is I now sit back rather than sort of get annoyed by that. I go, right, tell me about your typical day from the minute you wake up to the minute you go to sleep. And it gives me really rich information about their life. It gives me a snapshot of their life very quickly. I don't interrupt them, although I do like to talk, as you can tell. And it takes about 3 minutes for them maximum to give me a snapshot of their day. And if there's anything that they've missed out, I will ask a follow-up question, like, give me everything, you know, what your stress levels are like, what you eat, where you work, what your colleagues are like, what happens at home. And you know, sometimes something jumps out. A really good example is someone who I saw a while ago, who's a hairdresser, does not sit down in the day to eat their meals because of their job. And understandably, they have digestive symptoms, because if you don't sit down and eat and chew your food, your digestive enzymes don't get time to work. You will have heartburn symptoms. It's not because of low stomach acid, which is the propelled sort of myth about why people get heartburn. There's a real thing about thinking about what you're doing each day. And I don't think we do that nowadays, because we're all so busy, aren't we? You know, we just are the way that the world is. And so a lot of, you know, for yourself, for example, you know, that is a great starting point. Let's think about my typical day, you know, again, there are 8 things that give rise to your health in any one moment. And we can come on to that if you want. I can go through that in more detail. But
certainly, one thing I'm quite keen to touch on is these sort of issues, this, you know, person coming in and you ask to describe their day, these kind of issues can sort of sneak up on you. No, I feel awful, but not quite sure. And actually, so in fact, one of the podcasts that I listened to that you were talking about, this happened to you, didn't it?
You know. It did. I mean, my podcast is called Saving Lives in Slow Motion. And there's a reason it's called that, because that is what I think a GP essentially does. We don't have all the big heroic stories about sealing off blood vessels in the middle of the night and, you know, like trauma surgeons or whatever. But what we do is we see someone's life kind of unravel in front of us over many years. And, you know, what you've got to be able to do is, if you're getting a symptom or feeling rubbish, that is a communication from your, you know, that you have to interpret in a way. If you get a symptom, as I say, a lot of the time it's a sign of system malfunction. I'll give you a real life example. So digestive issues are huge, aren't they? They're everyone. I don't know anyone who's never had some sort of gut symptom. But if you think about your life, so, you know, we talked about someone's typical day, but if you also think about your past history, which I've got in front of me on someone's medical record, often what I see with people with digestive issues, whether it's IBS or reflux, is they have a history of huge antibiotic use when they're younger. So antibiotics, they can't tell the difference between good and bad bacteria. So they wipe out all your gut bacteria for a while. And why is that important? Because gut bacteria are the food for your immune system, most of which is in the gut. Now, if you keep giving a child antibiotics, it's a very common story. So a child who's born premature, not breastfed for whatever reason, doesn't matter why, and has lots of ear infections and tonsillitis when they're young, and they're shipped off to the GP who gives them a course of antibiotics. Say 8 or 9 times in childhood, you know, they get 8 or 9 courses of antibiotics. Not an uncommon story at all. But that child, if we don't acknowledge that story and do something about it, is primed to get tummy ache. You know, they start to come in with, oh, you know, he's got a bad tummy again. And the problem in medicine is we're very good at reassuring that there's nothing serious going on, but we're not always good at sort of joining up the dots in terms of why that child might have tummy ache. And one of the things I tend to recommend, and it's, you know, there is evidence on this, it's not one of these wacky woo things, is if you have a course of antibiotics, and that may be completely necessary, you should always follow it up with some probiotics afterwards, because that replenishes the good gut bacteria. Mm-hmm. It's a foreign substance that just floods the gut and just gets your gut flora, your gut bugs, back to where they should be. And that often stops that march that you see in children going forward with, you know, feeling tired all the time. Because, you know, if your gut flora are shot, you're going to get all sorts of symptoms. It's not just about gut flora, but it's one thing that, and it, you know, there's a whole slew of books out there, aren't there, in recent years on it. So people are aware of this.
So will this kind of thing continue into later life? So the adults that come and see you say, you know, I'm tired, my gut's hurt.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Absolutely.
So this will continue.
And actually, when I look back, and I had a consultation on the phone with someone with this for a different reason. It was a skin issue. But, you know, when I pieced his sort of story together, it was a real eureka moment. It's like, hang on, no one's ever told me this. You know, that makes complete sense. You know, the fact that I, you know, whatever was in his story kind of makes sense of where your health is now. Do you know what I mean? And, mm-hmm. and I think it's quite, that in itself is quite empowering for people, because they suddenly make sense of why they're feeling the way they're feeling, rather than not getting an explanation. Or,
and then they're likely to do something about it.
Yeah, because they think, you know, and especially if you, I mean, the hairdresser example is an interesting one, because once you explain something to someone, so I think with him, the first thing I said, look, you know, you start to break food down by chewing. There's something in the saliva called salivary amylase. It's an enzyme that breaks down carbohydrates. But you're eating so quickly because he's busy, you know, he's in a rush and he doesn't really get a break. So he's got a sandwich on the go whilst he's sort of cutting someone's hair or whatever. So, you know, if you're hoofing it down and standing up, you know, you've got, you know, what chance have you got to digest your food? What, you know, you've got to just sit, chew your, you know, but once you know, that's not evidence-based medicine. That's common sense, really, you know. But the problem is, you know, and that's another thing. A lot of people think that lifestyle medicine is all common sense. It's not all common sense. The first bits are the symptom resolution bits. Not always. You need a bit more of a 3D way of thinking. And again, I've tried to install that in my book for the public, because we teach it to doctors, but it's nice to know that you can do it, a lot of it, yourself. So
One thing that I picked up on actually on your podcast, when you were talking about things that sort of took you into writing your book, and I haven't read the book, I must admit, but you may well mention it there. I don't know. One of the issues you had was like an underlying infection. Now, yeah, we've just been through an extraordinary time when pretty much we've all had an infection. So I'm talking about COVID, but I just
think, of course.
And I often think, because I come across people that have long COVID, I think there must be an awful lot of people with underlying infections just now. So is this been addressed, and has this created a massive kind of issue which is going to cause problems for people like you for, you know, decades to come?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I really do feel for people with long COVID. It's a new long-term condition that didn't exist 4 or 5 years ago. We've suddenly got this population of people who have real symptoms, and in some cases their lives are falling apart, I have to say.
Yeah, it's awful. You know, I've spoken to people with long COVID. It is dramatic and awful, or can be.
Yeah. I'll explain that, and I won't go on too much about my own story, but in my case the infection I had was called dengue fever, which I got when I was about 19 or 20, traveling around Malaysia, Thailand and the Far East on a long sort of summer holiday while I was at medical school. And I got ill at that time for a while. It took me a good 6 months to recover. I lost a load of weight. I was in hospital for ages. But I forgot about it, as you do, because my health sort of got back to vaguely normal. But what viruses do, whether it's COVID or dengue fever or, anything else, is they leave an imprint, a sort of, a mark in your immune system. And when you get another virus coming along, so what COVID, the reason people with long COVID get so much fatigue is not the COVID itself. The COVID infection wakes up other viruses that the person has historically had. So a very common one is called human herpes virus 6, which most people will have had, or Epstein-Barr virus that causes glandular fever. So even if you and I, Mike, have never had symptoms of glandular fever, we will have had it, because when you do a blood test on people to see if they've got Epstein-Barr virus antibodies, 95% of the population have. So it's, there's a more than a 9 out of 10 chance that people have had it. But those viruses become reactivated, and it's the effect of those that cause this fatigue and what's known as dysautonomia, where people suddenly feel faint, or they get cold hands and feet, or they feel like they're gonna, or their blood pressure drops suddenly and they can't keep their blood pressure up. And it's a difficult thing to treat. The only, a lot of people ask me about supplements and things, and the evidence bases on supplements are not always that robust. And one of the ones that seems to help, and you'll find it on chronic fatigue forums, is called fulvic acid or humic acid. And it's an ancient compound from the Himalayas, often goes by the name of shilajit, which is a mixture of humic and fulvic acid. But what that does is it essentially, in layman's terms, it hides the virus from the immune system so that you don't get the fatigue symptoms. And a lot of people kind of go, yeah, I'm definitely a lot better on this fulvic acid that I've read about. But I'm not saying I, 100% recommend it. I don't have any problem with people trying it, but it's and again, you've got to realize these people are, a lot of people are desperate. I know of people who've gone from being super fit, running 10 Ks every weekend, to just being bedbound. I mean, that is just horrific, for that person. And so they're looking for something, whether it's, and there is some evidence on things like vitamin D supplementation, for example. And what I tend to try and do with that group is absolutely optimize. And they're in that group of people who I wouldn't say are desperate, but they're very motivated. They'll do anything. They don't need the behavior change because their lives have been taken away almost. So they will go on an anti-inflammatory type diet. They will prioritize their sleep. They will do pacing. They will optimize their, all the things that you can. And while I'm on that, sorry, Mike, going on to the eight factors that do govern our health in no particular order, and I want you to think about this for yourself if you're listening, are genetics, so your family history, environment, stress, sleep, diet, exercise, historic infections that we've just talked about, and sunlight. Sunlight is a euphemism for vitamin D. Now, if you look at anyone, the people that come in to see me, I mean, I've been doing this work for so long, I don't have to think about it because it jumps out. I can almost see the eight factors like a halo around their head. It's so obvious, and I learned this the hard way years ago because there was a lady who had real autoimmune symptoms, and we'd done a lot of work on diet and, optimizing things, and she'd got quite a lot better. But the real issue was environment for her. So she was in a really toxic relationship, and it was only after she left and moved away, she somehow sort of, she sent me a note to say, oh, dear Dr. Panja, thank you so much for all your help. Just to let you know, my symptoms have completely gone now. And actually, the thing that was making me ill was my relationship. I was in a, and I was, and I felt really, I had asked her, but I hadn't really drilled down on that. I felt a bit, oh my God, it was that all along. It wasn't just her
Sure.
thyroid, or it wasn't just, there was other stuff going on.
You can't prescribe that though, can you, as a doctor?
No, but it's it, and this is why actually this self, when I say self-care, part of it is also being able to lay out your story, because a doctor may not be able to do that because they're very focused, aren't they? You go in with a particular problem, and unless the problem is nebulous, which I love because I like laying the story out. I like those ones where people have got mystery symptoms because often I can unpick it, whereas a lot of doctors don't. They like something very defined, like, oh, you've broken your leg, you need XYZ, and you need a sick note for 12 weeks or whatever it is. So, It's a case of, it's a bit like being a detective, some of it. And again, that's level three, where you're trying to resolve symptoms. It's the nth level of lifestyle medicine. So the first bit is doing things that we all know we should be doing. The middle bit is transformation by doing those things, which improves your health. You lose a bit of weight, you feel a bit better, you don't feel so tired. And the last one is really for people who are feeling a bit broken. But it
Okay.
can do all of those. It just needs
So
laying.
those eight pillars that you've spoken about, those are in your book, The Health Fix.
Yes, that's
Right,
right.
excellent. So a little plug for the book there. Perhaps I should go away and read it for sure. I want to ask something now, which is slightly different, and I've never really asked a medical person about this before, but it's coming in the form more and more, this digital health. And we're in St Albans. It's quite a well-heeled sort of place. Lots of people have these watches, these things that can measure all kinds of stuff, their heart rate, their blood pressure, how many steps they do, and all that kind of stuff. Now, as a GP at the sharp end, is this helpful, or does it kind of create a worried well? Do people come to you and go, "I've been looking at my watch and I don't think my heart rate is what it should be." Is it kind of useful overall?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's part of normal life and nowadays. And what you're talking about, in a way, is where wellness, well-being, fitness, health, and illness all kind of mix in a Venn diagram. And historically, the National Health Service has really been a national illness service in some ways, because people come to us when they're not feeling well. And, the acute stuff like chest infections and the kind of things that you need to see the doctor or nurse about on the day because you're ill, is a massive sort of burden to the clinical system, and a lot of our work is urgent on the day stuff. But that monitoring element, which digital health gives you, is really useful. And nowadays, so many people sort of come in and go, "Oh, I don't know whether it's anything, but my watch is telling me my heart rate's irregular," or something like that. And then we will send them for an ECG, a heart tracing, and often they're right. So I think it's really good. I'm a real fan of it. I don't, you can see I'm not wearing a an Apple Watch or something like that, because I'm okay in that I'm not super techie. I've got nothing against it, but I'm not obsessed with that sort of stuff. But I do think it's really useful. And yes, it may increase the worried well a little bit, but anything that's going to help you change your behaviours or keep them in track and give you an early warning sort of system for things like blood pressure or heart rate, or is a good thing. The other great thing is that it's a way of tracking your progress. No different to apps like Strava for cycling. You can see what your recovery's like. And I think that's a good thing generally. And it doesn't it, it you know in terms of whether it's made my job harder, I don't think so, to be honest.
Okay. No, that's interesting, because I must admit, I find this whole digital health, not just in the personal measurement and stuff, really quite interesting. And one thing that I've come across, and I think is potentially fascinating, and again, you can tell me if this is good or bad as far as you're concerned. Useful is probably a better way. It's these symptom checkers. You can all kinds of different symptom checkers, and you can put your symptoms on a list or a computer, and it will spit out what potentially could be wrong with you. Now, do you have patients come to you with kind of the printout of their symptoms and say, "Look, I've definitely got this. I'm really worried. Help me," or
Yeah, not so much actually. And I do think that AI, which we're AI's actually here now, and it's used in almost every industry, isn't it? It's not something of the future anymore. And in a way, I love it. In a way, I'm very scared of it, because I think it's so intelligent. At some point, it will sort of outfox us as human beings, possibly. And there are good and bad symptom checkers. So, and not promoting anyone in particular, because I'm not I have no commercial interest in this at all. But there is one that I remember, which is very good. That it's a company called ADA Health, ADA, and they've got an amazing symptom checker. So what we did at work was people who had real conditions put in exactly what their symptoms were, and it almost always got it right, whereas a lot of the other ones didn't. And what you'll also find nowadays, if you try and access your GP, and this goes for, you know, my surgery, as you will know, Mike, you know, at the Maltings in St Albans, is, you know, we have a digital front door. So, and apart from people who are very elderly and possibly aren't online, most people are encouraged to actually put a form in via our website telling us what's wrong. Now, at the other end, so I'll give you an example where digital health works really beautifully, is we see a lot of ill children, you know, very common, isn't it? A child with a fever and a sore throat. And I'm sure your kids are probably older now, like mine. But when they're little, you know, they're often quite ill and you have to take them off to the doctor. What we now do, rather than sort of ask lots of questions on the phone about, like, oh, you know, has he got a rash and, you know, how high is the fever? We send something to the parent by text, which has got a pro forma with all those questions in. So the parent has to fill that in and send it back to us. And as soon as we get it back, we've got all that info. And what it means, you can very quickly tell whether that child's very ill, moderately ill, or not really ill at all, because you've got their temperature and their, you know, you've got all the sort of thing, the info from the parent, because often it will just go, you know, the online consultation that they put in is like, oh, my daughter's four and she's not well, I need to see a doctor, which doesn't really give you much info. And so I think digital health is, you know, we've only scratched the surface of what it can do. I mean, my dream, actually, you know, and I say this at the end of my book, is that one day we'll all be wearing something on our wrist that has it all. It's got, you know, in terms of my eight factors, it will have your genetic propensity to things, it will have, you know, your medical history on it, it'll have the whole lot, so you can just sort of, before you go into the surgery, scan it, and it will just sort of bring up, you know, but it's not far away. That is not far away, I don't think.
Certainly these things can help speed things up. On ADA, I actually spoke to one of the guys that started ADA, and he said a really interesting thing. He said the information that goes into it, because people will often put information into this before they see their GP, they've been able to pick up outbreaks of things before they're in the sort of public health domain. And he used the example of measles in New York, you know, and it just happened so quickly. And then if, you know, if we all did that, things could get a handle on outbreaks very fast. And I thought that was particularly interesting.
Yeah, that is amazing. And that's amazing from a public health perspective. And if you come all the way down to the one-to-one, the other thing that I was impressed by with them, they came to visit our practice, I think about 4 or 5 years ago. And back then, when AI wasn't so prevalent, this is like quite a long time ago now in terms of digital health, they said that they could, you know, using their software, that they had the capability of mimicking a particular doctor's behavior. And I was like, what, really? And I just couldn't get my head around that. But now I see how they could very easily, because, you know, you see all these AI memes of celebrities, don't you, and how they sound and look exactly like they do. And that's very powerful as well. And again, we do a lot of that digitally already, where, you know, you can set up text messages as prompts, you know, for behavior change for a particular patient, so that, you know, every week it's like, you know, hey, how's it going with, you know, the running, you know, kind regards Dr. Panda, or something like that, you know what I mean, just as a nudge. And again, nudges are quite useful, because you think, oh, actually, you know, it's a reminder that I need to do something. So yeah, I think I'm a real fan, but I'm not an expert in it, and I wish I knew a bit more about it, but you can't know about everything. You know, there are people who are so good at that sort of stuff, and it's best left to them.
Yeah. No, I think it's going to change things, and it's certainly going to change the way we interact with our GPs, for sure. So Ian, look, we've chatted about lots of different things. We've covered lots of ground. I think maybe a good last question, one last thing might be, what sort of good advice or sources would you suggest to people if they're thinking, goodness, having listened to this, maybe I do need to get a bit more proactive about my health, you know, to put off the time when I have to go along and see my GP. So what are some good sources, you know, NHS websites, website, etc. And do mention your book as well.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think people in general, and I it's very difficult to generalise because my old practice population was so different to where I work now. So 20 years ago in Tottenham, there were unworried, unwell people. People who are really sick and they have no idea and they really need to be in hospital. And it's a very different sort of dynamic and conversation. But so the NHS website is evidence-based and is really good for information. I think in terms of nuanced ideas in terms of whether to worry about things. I don't want to sound too self-promoting. My podcast, Saving Lives in Slow Motion, which is completely free and on all podcast platforms, covers, I've done over 100 episodes now. They're really short. They're between 10 and 15 minutes. And I cover, well, I'm almost run out of things to sort of talk about. Like, I think the one that's coming out tomorrow is on minor illness, because minor illness sounds really trivial. But it's only minor illness in retrospect. You know, earache could be something serious, but usually it's not. And my podcast is very useful to context. You know, my sort of strap line for myself is putting health into context, which I think is really difficult these days. We're bombarded, aren't we, by so many things, like the adverts on TV, like, if you've got blood in your stools, make sure you get it checked out. Well, of course, people are going to do that. They tend to sort of do that anyway. But knowing what to do, I think for reliable health information, I love the NHS website. I also like healthline.com, which is an American sort of website owned by Medical News Today. Again, it's all evidence-based. So if you want information on conditions, they're both really good. But in terms of your own lay referral, like when I need to see a doctor, which is this concept called lay referral, which is when you sort of check it out with friends and relatives, like, do you think I should go and see someone about that? If in the bottom line is, if in doubt, see someone, you know, and if something hasn't sort of resolved after a period of time that you would expect it to, you definitely need to see someone medical, I would say. But give my podcast a go, because it's really, you know, it's so bite-sized, and I use real life examples like I have today with you, which kind of make you think, hang on a minute, that's a really good point. I never thought about the way I do X or Y, you know, and I cover some specifics as well, you know, like whether it's sexual health or whether it's, you know, skin health or whatever, you know, there's lots of discrete topics as well. And the Health Fix, the book, is really for anyone who wants a deeper understanding of how to understand their own health and these kind of communications that your body might send and manifest as symptoms. It just lays out a really easy, elegant framework to get your health, you know, nearer where you want it, and hopefully sort of, you know, resolve symptoms as well.
Good. All right. Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time. And many thanks.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's been a pleasure as well.
Thank you very much to my guest on this week's show, and that was GP Dr. Ian Panja. Thank you very much to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. Have a healthy week. Until next week.